This is the Moonifest Destiny Podcast, number 35. Moonifest Destiny is a novel I wrote in 1991. The subtitle is The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. My name is Peter Gelman. If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please go back and start with episode 1. Moonifest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents. I will now read chapter 34, Showdown. Sitting down and resting, I wondered what I was going to do when the air changed, mixed in with the charred, sweet smell of powder smoke. It smelled freshly artificial, something like coke smoke and steam. I turned the knob of my annunciator. It slowly fogged up on 10,000 V. I picked up some sand and dropped it. That gave me the vector of the wind. I went windward down into the bowl of the crater. The crescent earth was just coming out of the clouds. From afar, in the growing light, his unnatural work was obscure, but hinted darkly of crime. He was perched on the hinges of his knees, as in devout prayer. His big porcelain head was tucked low in devotion, and his metal paws were clamped together before his boiler drum chest, pumping up and down in the fervor of his obeisance. But coming closer, I saw the heavy black round shot held in his hands, thumping down upon the doughboy corpse below him, hammering down and crackling the bones, splintering and shattering the rib bones, snapping the spine at the neck, and smashing the skull to pulp. Then he pulled a 10-inch bone fragment from the aperture of his benignly smiling lips, clean white but for a few clumps of tough gristle, and threw it in the open swinging iron furnace door. The parted sides of his unbuttoned vest dangled on either side like stage curtains, and inside the embers seemed satyrs of fire that pursued and embraced nymphs of bone. In this hellish puppet show, this industrial bacchanalia, I was unnerved. But even as he figured the sums of his wormy work, he hissed and shrilled to himself through his organ pipes, lisping softly and chiming metronymically, tick, tick, tick. The Where's the Spot waltz? Where's the spot? He said. Where's the spot? A young Whig stirred the congressional pot, making legal Dickory Dock of Young Hickory. Where's the spot where our blood fell quickery? Like a sheep with a shawl, you're self-contradictory. When you say war is declared by foreign action, for what's a Congress? We alone make war, is my guess. When Polk heard this peace and apestic, he told him how destiny was manifestic. War exists by foreign crime. When the plum is ripe, it's picking time. The big fin fish eats the littlest fin, or so says a friend of mine, name of Darwin. that able Whig Lincoln caught Polk by the hair and said, "Sir, I think I know your surveyor. He's a crooked fellow by the name of Faults. He's got us dancing this Where's the Spot waltz." The Eyes of Abolition got neighed by Polk's, "The common man is now crowned king. 54-40 or fight, we sing. Providence has given us all of the moon. I read it up in that there manifesto commune," said Lincoln. "Sir, I see your false step. This dance can't be done by Whigs," he wept. "Abe, I think this waltz is more of a quadrille. With the bloody light of glory shines the national will. Let's make that brave fort the town of Brownsville." I crept closer, holding the long electric bayonet before me. And now I spied the two tin buckets spilled beside him. It was plainly evident that the automaton had taken them from the surgeon's refuse, for they were piled around him, the neatly sawed-off arms and legs and feet and hands of the non-ambulatory casualty. I shuddered to see the same peckings and plucking polka-dotting upon those gray limbs as I'd seen in the grotesquely disinterred corpse of Sergeant Weigert. "Hold, monster! What are you doing?" I called. Prince President Franklin Stove puffed a bad black cloud from his stovepipe, and his knees creaked as he rose and turned. His glass eyes glowed gray and milk white with sooty and gritty saltpeter stains, making murky daguerreotypes of what? A hanging? A flogging? A branding? His furnace door clanked open and shut, showing and shuddering its lurid lantern, weird with what white shapes blackened there.
"Tick, tick."
"I am the moral surgeon," he said through the stiff, grinning pipe of his lips. "I give succor to the dead. I excise sins of the flesh. And before I am through, tick, tick, I will force you to pay my tax, too." I took a step back and looked away from the ambiguous mesmerisms of his eyes. "All right, demon stove," I called, and I pulled back the hammer of the electric bayonet switch with both thumbs. "I've come to settle the score. You got anything to say?" The automaton's dandy Bo Bremer face just grinned and grinned, monotonously benign. "Score? Tick, stick, tick, tick, tick. I count it thus. Tick." And his Babbage calculatin' machine mind ticking up some great sums, he told me the casualties of the last 2 days' battles, which, in my head, I automatically placed in the 8th and ninth inning of Sarah's scoreboard. Inning 1-5. Slowpokes 6. Pesky Lunars 6. Inning 6. Slowpokes 0. Pesky Lunars 0. Inning 7. Slowpokes 0. Pesky Lunars 0. Inning 8. Slowpokes 350. Pesky Lunars 54. Inning 9. Slowpokes 800. Pesky Lunars 122. Score. Slowpokes 1156. Pesky Lunars 182. Errors. Slowpokes 4. Pesky Lunars 500 plus. Dreadful fiend, I said. I'll stop that death's head grin. Let's see how 10,000 volts appeal to you. I ran the last few yards and thrust the bayonet against the preacher's suit. Pressing the bayonet against his tin barrel chest. At the same time, there was a hot blue spark. He rocked backwards, then forward. A bit of smoke curled from the charred cloth. The annunciator of my pile was dark, dead. I dropped that heavy box off my shoulders and the musket to wrestle or run. Tick! You are in error. My metal parts are mixed with wood and porcelain. I make a poor conductor, sir. Tick! Your flesh conducts your error. Tick! In fact, in the score of this game, you will make the fourth error. Tick! What is error? Tick! Error, ergo, freedom, he said, and he reached out. His hard hand clenched its vice on my wrist. So strong were his iron fingers, it was like being shackled. Bones glowed in the hot box of his belly, with ugly little coals and floating clumps of ash. Nymphs fled the stump-footed satyrs inside that hissing fire. It hissed, insidiously persistent, as it shrank. The metal man ticked twice and pulled my hand. I was helpless. Was he going to thrust it in that fire? Help! Tick! But I only want to give you a fraternal kiss, it said, and lifted my hand to its jaws. There was a click. His jaw fell open a notch. He lifted up my hand. Oh, help! There was a small dark slot there. He pressed my hand against the hole and bit me. It was a darting, deep bite. Murder! Bang! Clang! A rifle shot ripped the black suit. I heard horses behind me. There was a rush of men and hooves. The metal man released me and turned as pow! Clang! Wallace Gordon's pistol burst open a new buttonhole as his iron ribs clanged like a bell. Sarah tossed a lasso around the Prince President's neck, and he flew backward, landing heavily. She dragged him a few yards, then leapt off the horse and pounced on him. She held her Colt to his face. He reached for her. Watch out! He bites! holding my wounded hand. Sarah jumped back. My hand hurt bad and tingled. Captain Sewell and Six Fingers rode up, the latter's rifle smoking. Sewell jumped down with his wooden canteen and rushed over. He kicked the furnace door open and poured water into it. The metal man started to sit up, but Sarah stepped on the rope between his neck and her horse. He fell back again. Great steam poured around Captain Sewell. The ranger tossed the captain his gourd next. The other riders caught up, and the contents of six canteens burst into steam. The metal man's boiler pressure dropped slowly. He was weakening. He looked up at his captors with watery white glass eyes. His ticking stopped, then continued unsteadily. Captain Mansfield unpacked a small chest from his saddle. It was full of tools. He took a hammer and a chisel and set it against the edge of the porcelain mask. Tock, tock. It wouldn't budge. His pink painted face seemed so stupid and tawdry. A thinning little trickle of smoke curled out of his top hat. A last weak puff of steam emitted from his nostril pipes as he said, so faintly, "Wait, tick, but I now have 9 lectures. Wait, tick. The 9th is wait, tick, wait, tick. The case for necessity of and practical methods of drilling orang-utans as obedient volunteers for, tick, the United States Army. Wait, tick, wait, tick, tick, tick." He seemed to be ticking faster again. I was surprised to hear his Babbage calculating machine brain ticking and whirring more furiously than ever, now that his furnace was cooling, his boiler settling, his toy marble eyes nearly black. He lay there on the broken battlefield, weakly lit by the gibbous good sphere that so many months ago had let loose a volley of steam balloons in an invasion of the moon. A shiver shook me. What could account for it? What could account for his ticking now? He whirred and whirred. Wait, tick, tick. I have 10 lectures. Tick. I have 11. Frantically, as if he wasn't really dead. "Peculiar engine," said Captain Mansfield. "But if he's just an engine," said Six Fingers, "then he never was alive. So he can't be dead?" "With his boiler system shut down, what powers his calculations? How do I open up this thing?" Captain Mansfield looked around the ears for some kind of clasp or hinge. "I know how to open her up," Sarah offered. "By all means, go ahead," said Mansfield, standing up. She kneeled. "Professor, I'm sorry to have to tell you, your goose is cooked." Holding her colt by the barrel, she hammered the butt right against the center of the porcelain plate of a face. The white nose shattered, leaving just a dark hole like a jack-o'-lantern and two slender copper tubes bent askew. Horrified, we stared. Some strange organ wriggled within the hollow of the head. The thing cried, "Er-er-er-er-er-woo!" It jerked its squirmy little head out of the hole that the blow had made and quickly snapped it back inside. But in that instant, I'd seen its ugly little eyes and snapping mouth. "Nasty," said Sarah, straightening up. She yanked her Bowie knife from its sheath and squatted back down beside the fallen foe. Carefully, blade at ready, she peeked into the hole. She peered inside the cavity. "It's all hollow inside there. I can't see but two little rooms. There ain't no cabbage calculating machine in there at all. I see straw, feathers. There are about a baker's dozen levers that look like spoons, look like all kinds of wires, pulleys, and little gears up top. Oh, there's that nasty feller again." All of a sudden, that ugly-eyed little head poked out of the hole. It jerked this way and that, eyeing Sarah curiously, then snapped back in. Sarah followed it with her eyes. "Hey, I know what that is. What do you know? It's picking on one of them spoons. It's grabbing on a tiny lever and pressing on it to get the spoon down. It's pecking on it. There's some kind of gore on that spoon. When he pecks it, it kind of gets knocked around. He's pecking all kinds of levers." Indeed, you could hear the steady tick, tick, tick. Sarah looked up at us. "Oh dear, oh dear. That's a bloody button on the spoon. Says U.S. "He is a cannibal then," pondered Captain Mansfield. "How utterly savage," said Captain Sewell, straightening. "Shh, he's talking," said Sarah, putting her ear close to those copper nostril tubes. After a moment, she lifted her head. "What did he say?" asked Sewell. "I don't know. I don't think I heard him right." "What did it sound like?" asked Mansfield. Sarah's eyebrows frowned. "Sounded like he said, 'Not goose.'" With her left hand, she snapped her fingers in front of the hole. The thing looked inside. The thing inside looked, then lunged. It nipped her fingers with its quick, sharp beak. It drew blood, but Sarah grabbed around the ugly little head even as it bit. She pulled it tight. The neck stretched out a long ways, 5 inches. She sawed it hard with her knife. It screamed. Snick! The neck snapped in two. It was a little chicken's head, a bantam rooster. The head sat in her bloody hand, its beak convulsively opening and closing. The tongue pressed in and out slowly. The faceplate of the metal man knocked open from the inside. Then I saw again what I had seen many times back at the farm. The headless body of the bantam flapped wildly. Its shredded neck honked and bleated, "Roo! Roo!" spraying blood as it flapped its headless wings and rose up crookedly into the air. Blindly it flew, twisting, flapping, and bleeding. Then it fell. It let out a last weak honk and flopped down on the battlefield. We crowded around the open cavity of the metal man's head. It was a mess of blood and feathers. Two little hens lay dead in the back, where a nest had been. There were two chambers. The chickens lived in the larger of the two. Beneath it, only an inch high, level with the mouth, was the second. It was empty. I saw the levers that Sarah had described. Did just the random peckings of those birds against the levers direct the motions of the automaton? Asked Captain Mansfield, frightened and angry. Undisturbed, Sarah reached in and pulled out the two little hens. In the nest, something moved. A snake slithered up and out of the head, an egg in its mouth. Rattler! Cried Sarah, jumping back. Hiram squinted along his barrel, and bang! The snake head broke open. The egg rolled free. Nice shot, Hiram, laughed Sarah. I'd be pleased to cook up that nice, fresh chicken egg for you. I looked at my hand. It wasn't a mere peck. I could now make out the twin red holes made by poison fangs. I'm snake bit, I said weakly, and sat down. I'll fix you up, said Sarah. Just think of the nice chicken soup we'll get tomorrow. While Sarah was cutting X's on the fang holes, and sucking and spitting the blood, Captain Mansfield was poking in the face cavity of the metal man. It smelled filthy inside. He found two more dead rattlers. Three chickens, their eggs, and three snakes? The nests each have a hole in them, through which the snakes feed on the eggs. The snake could kill the chickens, but looks like they didn't. The eggs kept them from being hungry. That's all it is. Little beasts moving pulley wires when they feed. The rote animation of little brutes. That's all it is. That's all there is. He kept saying, that's all there is, over and over, until Captain Sewell put a hand on his shoulder. Mansfield stood up and with tears in his eyes kicked the dead doll. The men packed up the chickens and the rattlesnake too. I was so worried and exhausted. And that rattler poison was getting me because I felt dizzy and sick. Sarah put me on her saddle and rode behind me, holding me on when I had a weak spell. Only out of charity, she explained. Get my idea? You read up my note, she asked, a bit proud. I just groaned affirmation, too sick to protest. We arrived. Captain Sewell hailed Fort Texas to open the gate. An aggrieved shout went up amongst us when the reply came that by General Taylor's orders, it wasn't called Fort Texas no more. Major Brown was dead. I kept wondering if that poison in my blood was what Prince President Franklin Stove had meant when he warned me, "Tick, your flesh conducts your error. Tick, in fact, in the score of this game, you will make the fourth error. Tick. What is error? Tick, tick, tick. Error, ergo, freedom." Thank you for listening. In November 2003, somebody posted an essay on Manifest Destiny. Somebody wrote an essay speculating on the nature of Prince President Franklin's stove. I am not sure if the original was on a website or an old listserv called the Writer's Block or something else, but it is currently still on the internet, and I made a shortcut for it, which is go.gl/KDP4K. I will read it to you. Title: One of Those Eureka Moments. Description: If you value your sanity, run. November 9th, 2003. A week or two ago, I was reading this story online. It was hosted by some site, sci-fi fantasy magazine. The story was a 20-plus chapter affair called Manifest Destiny. It's set in the time frame of the 1800s, I believe before the American Civil War had started, although the actual date is never mentioned. Pausing now, this is me talking here. I do mention it at the end of chapter 4, April 1846. Returning now to the essay. Because of the mentioning of backward science mixed with political views of the time frame, I am certain that it is supposed to be a satirical work. The reason it grabbed my attention was the mention of steampunk technology, electrical weaponry, steam-powered aircraft, and a clockwork automaton. The main character is a man in the army who is part of an invasion force sent by steam balloon to liberate the moon from the local government. The lunar people, incidentally, speak with Spanish or English with Spanish accents, and the U.S. government has proclaimed the moon to be the Peninsula of Texas. They've already sent troops to Venus and gotten some sort of victory there. I believe the author was trying to make a number of points, but being so machine-minded, I've probably missed most of them and garbled the others. 1. The Mind of Man. The automaton, called Prince President Franklin's Stove, does several lectures throughout the book on a variety of subjects. One was delivered right after some soldiers dug up a prehistoric dragon-like skeleton while building the fortifications of the base. The author, through the main character, explains how the sight of the fossilized bones thoroughly demoralized the troops, triggering a primitive, instinctual response in connection to the most basic parts of the mind. Stove's lecture that follows is something that to me is an absolutely beautiful logic string, which applies logic, if, then, and action-reaction, right down to the line to a solidly developed conclusion. The only thing that would have made it better is that the end conclusion might make sense. The whole conclusion can be summed up in the phrase, "The rational is irrational, and the irrational rational," which I think is a direct quote from Stove. Somehow, this odd oratory manages to buck up the confidence of all the soldiers there, though I am certain that not a single one of them could have understood what the F was being said. I think half of it was in the fact that the soldiers were willing to put their faith into any figure of authority that offered a pleasant alternative to the primitive sense of fear they were feeling, be it God, the president, a general, or a well-spoken machine. In spite of, or perhaps because, they didn't understand it, they were willing to trust it. Why? It was easier to assume the reasoning was sound and have a way to stop worrying than it was to go through the logic of each statement and check to see if it was correct. This kind of irks me, and it used to confuse me until I figured out this basic truth of humanity. Most people would rather not feel bad. This doesn't hold true for me. It's not that I'm a masochist. It's merely that I find the alternative, turning away, not knowing, more painful than things like guilt, sadness, a hammer applied with great force to a thumb. 2. Politics versus reason. The duo-heliocentric system is mentioned in this story in reference to the science of the era, much of which still depended on the sun revolving around the earth instead of vice versa. The duo part comes in since all the other planets revolve around the sun. This links science and politics because a soldier asks Stove to explain the scientific troubles in terms of the presidents, past and present. The duo part comes in since all the other planets revolve around the sun. This links science and politics because a soldier asks Stove to explain the scientific troubles in terms of the presidents, past and present. Stove never does this. He never gets the chance because his resulting conclusion angers many of the soldiers. But the conclusions he does come to reveal the political climate of the time. They could be summed up in one point of the argument. The earth alone shall determine the fate of the inner spheres. This seems very arrogant to me, but I think that to anyone who thought that, it seemed valid, using the following basis. Everything, one way or another, revolves around the earth. Of course, this is inaccurate, and the main character mentions that the astronomers of the day were pointing out flaws in the design. It seems fairly obvious that since a scientific model is just that, a model, finding flaws in the model are not a problem. However, this character puts so much faith in the science that he thinks that if the model is proven to be wrong and broken, the same thing will happen to the real thing, so that by picking apart the model because it doesn't work, the real solar system is destroyed and flies apart, which doesn't happen, of course, but reveals the mindset involved. A possible metaphor eventually becomes clear. If the assumption that the Earth, read United States, was no longer the center, read the most important part, of the known universe, read planet, then the whole idea of the universe, read manifest destiny, and the universe itself, manifest destiny again, was inherently flawed. However, Stove partially demonstrates this too bluntly and gets tarred and feathered by the hyper-patriotic troops. The moral is never try to reason with a soldier. 3. Trusting and blaming machines. Prince President Franklin Stove was constructed along the basic construction lines of the human body, of course adapted to metal and wood materials, However, his brain was the biggest question mark of all, because partly he seemed governed by pure reason, but his behavior was also repugnant to many of those involved, not to mention myself when I read it. Stove's power source is a steam boiler with an efficient furnace that can operate on burnable materials such as coal and refuse. However, a major downside becomes apparent later on when Stove offers cremation for the fallen soldiers killed in the war thus far in order to power himself. Now, let's look at this systematically. Pros: frees up the time and effort from the soldiers so they can fight and such, instead of digging a grave and burying the dead, especially in such limited space as the fort they're in. Also allows Stove to operate without delving into their supply of coal. Cons: kind of gives Stove an incentive to see that the battles and fights continue with heavy casualties, doesn't it? Eventually, Stove runs off, and it isn't until rescue forces arrive that troops can go out and try to catch him. He's caught by the main character, breaking a lunar soldier's arm into bite-sized pieces that he can place in his furnace. Stove seems to be a model of the process of war itself. It explains itself as being useful and interesting and good in many ways. When Stove first appears, he talks at great length about his precision construction and efficient steam reclamation process, among other things. But eventually, often too late, those close to it find out that it's not as good a deal as they thought, because it feeds off the lives of their friends, comrades, and if they're unlucky, them. Another metaphor shows up during the last fight with Stove. The main character has been hauling around this steampunk-type lightning gun, which he uses on Stove. It doesn't work very well. Stove's metal parts conduct electricity so well that none of them are damaged, and the wood and porcelain here and there keep the parts that could be damaged from being harmed. The guy gets hurt seriously and almost gets his hand bitten off by Stove before some others come in the nick of time and send some old-fashioned rifle rounds through Stove, screwing up some of his internal mechanisms. Then they start pouring water on his furnace fire to shut him down for good, interrupting the weakest part of the cycle of the war machine. The lightning gun was a symbol of military superiority, but it was not effective against the war machine. However, the less advanced, simpler muskets and rifles were, as was the application of water to the fire. You can't stop a war by fighting fire against fire. A war can only stop when there's no support, no reason to fight anymore. 4. Prince President Franklin Stove's other dark secret. When they start pouring water on the fire and cooling down the boiler to shut down Stove, he actually starts becoming more active. Throughout the story, whenever he talks, he adds in these little sound effect type things, like the hissing of steam, the ticking of clockwork, and he also has this bizarre speech impediment where he'll say the word eggs several times when saying any syllables phonetically similar, like in Texas. Now everyone finds out why. Inside Stove's head is no clockwork adding machine, but a miniaturized, compartmentalized control room inhabited by several chickens and snakes. Through the simple acts of pecking levers and pressing studs and knobs, the chickens fed off the offal of the snakes and possibly some of the stuff that the stove body was eating, and the snakes fed off of the chicken eggs. The control levers and buttons that controlled the feeding processes also controlled the driving forces that the rest of the stove's clockwork handled. At any time, the snakes could have attacked and killed the chickens, but the eggs kept them fed. As the stove was being cooled down, the animals became frantic. Whether they understood what was happening to their habitat, or if they were just not liking the loud noises and violent shakings, is anyone's guess, and began pecking and pushing at an accelerated rate. Stove seems to talk faster and seems to develop new things to say. They open up Stove's head, kill the chickens and snakes, and are done with it. Though one man doesn't take this too well, I suppose that he doesn't like the idea of the simple, primitive acts of feeding and action-reaction are the basis for all sorts of complicated behavior. Because Stove seemed fairly human, and it might have been too human to argue that our behavior is different from simple action-reaction on such a primitive level. One could even argue that the snakes were the id and the chickens' ego, and the balance between the two creates reason. But it's fairly sketchy. What jumped into my head after turning this around in my head for a while is this. It explains why so many people are afraid of AI, artificial intelligence, robots, computers, and why this idea is involved in so many movies and stories where robots try to do something bad to humans, but still get their asses kicked somehow. Humans are afraid of self-aware machines because it means that self-awareness and consciousness and all that good stuff can be found, quantified, and inserted into an inert mass of metal. And if it can be put into a machine, it can be taken out of a machine. Even if a person is a slave, has all rights and freedoms taken away, they still have their own personality and mind. Take that away and the person is completely destroyed, just like in death. Except in death, the bodies are not viable for use by some other force or power, except maybe vengeful spirits and that kind of thing. I believe that at a very basic level, humans fear that if scientists can find out what makes humans human, call it the soul, and learn to put it into a computer program, then someone will soon after figure out how to remove the soul from a human, which is really hitting below the belt. This fear is expressed in movies like 2001, the Terminator movies, and to a lesser extent, the Matrix trilogy, and simultaneously allayed, because most of the time, the machines lose. The machines are embodiments of pure reason, but there's usually some quality that humanity still has a monopoly on that helps them defeat the machines, be it some kind of moral compass, the ability to feel emotions, creativity beyond what the machines can predict and counter, or sheer stubbornness. The movies are appeals to the human ego, saying, no matter how advanced they are, we'll still have the upper hand somehow. Of course, in some movies, Matrix, this is a very limited somehow. And in still others, Colossus, the Forbin project, the somehow isn't even there. Say for movies like the Forbin project, malicious robots and cyborgs always have some problem from humanity. Nuclear war? Bah, there are survivors, and they're a pain in the mechanical ass. In 2001, despite HAL's best efforts, Dave managed to get back in the ship and lobotomize him. And as for the Matrix, well, there's Zion, the Resistance, Neo, all that stuff. Machines never completely win, and this is often because of flaws that are inherent in the machinery or programming. I'm not sure what my point is, but I think it has something to do with human psychology dealing with things on multiple levels. I could be wrong about that, though. It's past 5:30 in the morning here, and I'm tired as hell. Any comments? Somebody called Kovacs writes, quote, "The whole conclusion can be summed up in the phrase, the rational is irrational, and the irrational, rational," which I think is a direct quote from Stove. Kovacs writes, "Heh, very Tao, also interesting, considering the chicken snake source." Quote, "Humans are afraid of self-aware machines because it means that self-awareness and consciousness and all that good stuff can be found, quantified, and inserted into an inert mass of metal." Kovacs writes, "Humans always had trouble quantifying their souls. Take animals or plants, for instance. Would they have souls? And what would be the quantifiable difference? If I cut off my finger and it is still technically alive for a few moments, does it have a soul? Does it have a piece of my soul then? And am I somehow diminished because of that mutilation? Makes you rethink the whole idea of why disabled people are treated like crap. Humans want to be unique, and they want that uniqueness to justify their actions, manifest destiny again, because those actions justify their uniqueness. As so, that was always a problem when encountering another race." Quote, "Did the Indians have souls? The Negroes? No, of course not. They are no more than animals, not being able to comprehend the full extent of spiritual and intellectual suffering," unquote, is their reasoning. And you know how the historical stuff happened after that. The machine artificial intelligence is no different. Where once upon a time, the cool stories were about a brave man braving the wrath of soulless cannibal natives. Now the brave man braving the wrath of the soulless machine. So once we had animals in human form, i.e. the quote, mongrel races, unquote. Now we have machines in human form as a threat to our place in history, destiny, or whatever. That's it. I hope you enjoyed hearing these writers' thoughts on Franklin Stove and the novel in general. I'm sorry I don't know their names. Hope they don't mind me borrowing their words. It means a lot to me to see a thoughtful person cogitating on the themes and meanings and further resonances of my first novel, something I worked very hard on. Some of the minor details I might disagree with, details that aren't very important to the main point of what the author is trying to say. It's also illuminating to me to get another person's perspective on something I have only seen from the inside. I hope that you enjoyed that. If you have gotten this far in the podcast, then I am supposing that you are interested in these kind of discussions and have some thoughts on that yourself. There is only one more chapter to the story. If you would like to contact me and say something nice, my email address is petergelman@yahoo.com. Moonifest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents. Thank you.